This is the West Texas Dispatch. I'm George Levesque. Mental Health Awareness Month has been observed since 1949, every May. But this year, KACU's Josiah Wannell is taking a closer look at one of the most persistent intersections in public life, mental illness and the criminal justice system, with a series entitled Minds on Trial. Episode 1 laid out the problem, how people with serious mental illness cycle through jails and hospitals, rarely getting the treatment they need. Now the response is Episode 2, The Solutions. It looks at what Texas has built in response, the courts, the laws, and the people trying to close the gap. He begins, though, with a story.
There is a story told about a man who got a flat tire outside a state psychiatric hospital. As he knelt in the grass searching for the lug nuts he'd scattered, a patient appeared at the fence, watching. After a moment, the patient called out, "Take one lug nut off each of the other tires. You'll have three on each wheel. You can make it home before it rains." The driver looked up, stunned. He said, "How does a smart guy like you wind up in a place like this?" The patient smiled.
"They may think I'm crazy, but I'm not stupid."
Judge Oscar Kazin has been telling that story for years, from the bench in Bexar County, San Antonio, where he built something Texas has never seen before. He tells it because it does in 10 seconds what policy papers cannot. It forces you to reconsider what you think you know about who ends up in the system and why. Judge Brent Carr spent 32 years on the bench in Tarrant County, including more than two decades running specialty courts for people with mental illness, veterans, and survivors of trafficking. The numbers he carries with him are not abstract.
In the confinement population, particularly in the jails, it runs as high as 65%. So it's more than 300% more than what you would find in the general population.
300%. And the gap sharpens when you look at serious mental illness specifically.
About 4% of the general population has serious mental illness, and almost 20% of people in confinement have serious mental illness.
1 in 5, behind bars. The fix did not come from one place, or one person, or one bill. It came in layers, and it started with communication. For decades, the courts, the clinics, law enforcement, and the hospitals had been operating on separate tracks, speaking different languages, rarely in the same room. Professor Brian Shannon is a legal scholar at Texas Tech who has spent more than three decades shaping mental health law in Texas.
Texas, to my knowledge, was the first state in the country where our two high courts — we're unusual that way to have two high courts — but the Supreme Court over civil cases and the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals over criminal cases met together, had hearings about some of these issues, and established the Texas Judicial Mental Health Commission.
Established in 2018, the commission was built to be a bridge, training judges, drafting legislation, publishing bench books, and hosting statewide summits. Its mission was straightforward: get the right people in the same room and then keep them there. But Shannon is quick to point out what a commission alone cannot do.
We can't solve all of the challenges and issues just with new laws. And for a lawyer to say that, I have to admit, we can't solve it all with changes in the law and new laws. It has to come hand in hand with sufficient and appropriate services.
Laws without resources are just paper. And Judge Carr learned that lesson early, not from a textbook, but from the cases that didn't go the way he hoped.
The research is pretty standard that you do have better outcomes as long as during the participation period, you also do exit planning. I mean, you can't surround people with resources, pull the rug out from under them, and expect them to thrive indefinitely.
What Texas needed wasn't just a new policy. It needed a new architecture, one that kept people connected to care long after the courtroom door closed. And one judge in a probate court in San Antonio had already started building it. Judge Oscar Kazin did not set out to become a pioneer. He lost a re-election bid by 6 votes. 6, and was preparing to leave the bench entirely when a fellow judge offered him a role overseeing civil mental health commitments in Bexar County. He took it, and what he found there changed the direction of his career. People were being hospitalized, stabilized, discharged, and then left entirely on their own. No team, no follow-up, no structure. Weeks later, sometimes days later, they were back.
if we can take a certain class of people that are consistently going in and out of hospitals, who are taken, stabilized, and then left alone, and then a month later, they're right back, or 6 months later, they're right back. Or worse yet, they left from the hospital and weren't paid attention to again, and we find them dead.
Kazin looked at the drug court model, which had shown the consistent judicial involvement paired with wraparound services could break cycles that jail alone never could. And he asked, why can't we do the same thing for mental illness?
I took that statute and say, I'm not just going to discharge you. I'm going to wrap a team around you. The court is going to be responsible to you. The staff is going to be responsible to you. You're going to be responsible to your mental health and the court. And together we're going to figure out a way to have you succeed.
What he built became known as Assistant Outpatient Treatment, or AOT. It is, at its core, a court-ordered treatment program for people with serious mental illness who have a documented history of cycling through crisis. A judge oversees a structured treatment plan, a team consisting of a psychiatrist, social worker, case manager, defense attorney, and prosecutor meet regularly. The goal is not punishment, it is continuity. Professor Shannon, who has helped draft the legislation that brought AOT formally into the Texas Criminal Code, describes how the docket worked in its earliest days.
As he started up, he talked about how he would have all of the participants in the matter. So representatives from the treatment team, the person subject to the order, appointed counsel for the individual, county attorney, all come in for a docket call, let's say every 2 weeks. And at that docket call, you'd say, you know, sometimes it was more than this, but I asked three basic questions. How you doing today? Do you have a good week? Have you been taking your meds? Did you go to your appointments?
Three questions. And the results for that initial population were immediate.
And just having that team together and the black robe effect of the judge being there, they, for this population that they started out with, they greatly reduced state hospitalization for that population, kept people in the community longer. And some early studies showed that recommitments are down, staying with medication is up.
The black robe effect, the way that the perceived authority of a judge used not to threaten, but to engage, cuts through the noise in a way that clinical appointments alone cannot. What that sounds like in practice has almost never been heard outside a courtroom, until now. Judge David McLean presides over an AOT docket in Bexar County, the same court Kazin built. What you're about to hear is one of the first times an AOT docket in Texas has ever been recorded and shared publicly. The patient's identity is protected, but the conversation is real.
What else can we help you with? What else is going on?
Insurance.
Like health insurance? Okay.
So when you saw the doctor Friday, did they get you prescriptions? Good.
Perfect. So we'll deliver them to you then. You'll say even better.
Medications, insurance, a doctor's appointment on Friday. This is what the docket is for, to care for the individual.
Do you know what medications you're taking right now?
Taking Lexapro and Risperidone.
Awesome. Okay. You sound like you're doing great. You feel good? Medication seem to be working well? What's your diagnosis?
Major depression.
Mm-hmm. And that's it?
With psychotic features.
Okay. All right. So if we get out of balance, you start having some hallucinations and things like that, right? Okay. So you don't want to get out of balance, right? No. So that's good. And the medications seem to be controlling that at the level they're at right now. Everything's going good. I'm so glad to hear that. That is awesome. That is really, really good.
This is not a sentencing. There is no threat in the room. The judge knows the person's diagnosis. They know when they last saw a doctor. They know what happens when the medication stops.
Part of what this program, actually the main goal of this program, is keep you out of the hospital, right? Keep you out of jail. Because sometimes our mental health can end up having those effects where we end up in one of those two places. So hopefully what we can do with this program is help you develop some habits and some practices and gain enough knowledge where you're able to manage your own mental health, okay?
Manage your own mental health. That is the end game, not permanent supervision, graduation. A person who no longer needs the court because the court helped them build something that holds on its own. Judge Kazin spent years watching that work. He also spent years watching people misread what it is and what it isn't.
But understand that AOT is not the silver bullet.
Okay.
It is a tool in the chest that helps a certain category of people most of the time. But it's not the alternative to long-term hospitalization when long-term hospitalization is needed. It's not the alternative. It's going to sound weird. It's not even the alternative to somebody who just needs to go to jail, because sometimes people just need to go to jail, right? And it's the people who try to make it the silver bullet, or the people who try to make it out to be the devil itself, that I think do it an injustice.
For years, AOT in Texas was primarily a civil tool, a way to help people before they crossed paths with a police officer. But a massive gap remained. If someone with a serious mental illness was arrested on a low-level, nonviolent charge, they often became trapped in the competency restoration loop, waiting months or years in jail for a state hospital bed just to become fit for a trial that might only last an hour. In 2019, the Texas legislature passed Senate Bill 362. For the first time, judges had a way to pause certain low-level, nonviolent criminal cases and transfer them into the civil mental health system.
But we create this additional option as if the person appears competent, then you could, in effect, hold this prosecution in abeyance and then kick it over to this probate court, the court with jurisdiction over a civil commitment, to look at whether the person meets criteria for an outpatient civil commitment.
This isn't just a legal tweak. It is a fundamental shift in how the state views its responsibility. By using Senate Bill 362, Texas is reaching a brand new population, people who used to be the system's problem but are now the team's focus. Court-mandated treatment programs, particularly those involving mental illness, are not the kind of policy that campaigns are built on. Judge Kazin remembers the climate in which he started.
When back in those days, if you were going to get elected, you didn't get elected talking about therapy and helping people and changing their lives. You had to be tough on crime. In the late 90s and the early 2000s, everything was real tough justice. That was on every campaign sign.
And yet, it passed. Professor Shannon believes the reason is simpler than it looks.
A lot of the issues we're talking about are mental health or are not liberal issues or conservative issues. They're more administration of justice issues, good government issues, where I think there's a lot of common ground.
Kazin's own program became the evidence when you look at the numbers.
We did a study several years ago about random 100 people that had gone through the program. We cut their hospitalization rates and arrest rates by 80%.
Financially, it's equally stark.
The average bill of costs for an individual that we pick up and put in a hospital bed or emergency room is $2,000 a day. A day. And if we can cut that over their lifetime by 80%, this thing pays for itself in the first week.
This efficiency is vital because the current system has flipped its mission entirely.
State hospitals, which originated primarily to serve a civil population, to keep people out of the criminal justice system, that's flipped. And today, out of their patient beds, persons there, they're about 75% criminal forensic cases and only 25% civil.
Texas has not solved this. No state has. The waiting lists are still long, the rural gaps are still wide, and the debate over coercive care is far from settled. But what Texas has built through the commission, through AOT, through specialty courts, and through Senate Bill 362 is a system with more doors than it had before, more entry points, more moments when a person can be seen before they fall, rather than after. I'm Josiah Winnell in Abilene.
The multidisciplinary thinking approach didn't start in Texas. It was pioneered in a courthouse in Miami-Dade County by a judge who believed the only way to solve a problem this complex was to stop asking one system to carry it alone. Episode 3 of Minds on Trial, entitled The Miami Model, airs next Wednesday at noon on the West Texas Dispatch. This series was produced with assistance from the Public Media Journalists Association Editor Corps, as funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. Welcome back to the West Texas Dispatch. Another election is behind us. Another runoff ahead of us. Last Saturday, a small number of local voters decided who will be making decisions on school boards and in city council meetings. KACU's Heather Claiborne spoke with McMurray political science professor Paul Fabrizio about the election that just wrapped up and what's ahead.
We have to start by talking about turnout. It's always lower when the ballot doesn't have the President of the United States at the top. But there were some competitive races, especially place four in Abilene City Council race, which we'll talk about more in a minute. Why don't people show up for school board and city elections when they have the most access and the most influence?
And it has the greatest effect on their lives.
Right.
I mean, when you look at it, a presidential election, for the most part, doesn't affect us much in terms of our day-to-day life, whereas a city council, or if you got kids in schools, a school
right.
district election, those matter. So you're asking a really good question. And I'd like to say that there's a really good answer, but I'm struggling to come up with one. There's a couple points. Number one, I think the candidates were unable to get the voters excited. And I just think that the absence of issues, the lack of money to really effectively advertise, led to a low turnout election. But we didn't have it. We didn't have any of those
very,
things.
Very, very low turnout.
Very. It was embarrassingly low. You know, the mayor's running for re-election and nobody's challenging
right.
the mayor. One of the two seats for Abilene City Council, running unopposed.
Right.
And, you know, it's not that these guys aren't good guys, but are things going that well in the city that two of the three positions that are open attract no attention and nobody challenges anybody on the Abilene School District Board? In one way, it's a sign that people are satisfied with how things are going. In another way, I think it's a bad sign for our democracy. We need to be involved. We need to have good discussion about what's going on. And we aren't having it right now.
And we did have four people that wanted to serve this city by being part of the city council for that place four seat.
Right. Thank God they all ran.
Yeah. Ben Bailey got 32%. So he'll be in the runoff against Tammy Fogle, who got 26%. Allison Carroll was right behind her at 25%, and less than three dozen votes separated that second and third place.
I know.
And then Lyles got about 16%. How do you see the outcome for that race?
Normally, the candidate who does well the first time, if they're forced into a second election, they do well. However, there is this strange thing that takes place when there is a runoff, that sometimes the person who finishes second wins. And the reason for it is that the greatest number of people who supported the candidate in first place have supported the candidate in first place, and everybody else didn't like that first place candidate. The man who finished in first place, he's not well known. So I'm not sure that the people who voted for the third and fourth place finishers mm-hmm. are going to then turn around and say, oh, I voted for the third and fourth place finishers because I didn't like number one.
Hmm.
I'm not sure I see that happening. I think instead this is an opportunity for both the first and second place finishers to go and reintroduce themselves in a very short period of time mm-hmm. to the voters.
And this is a turning point for this city on a number of issues. And mm-hmm. so, you know, things are looking good financially, but there are a lot of other things that need to be decided around how they manage spending and projects that need to happen. I mean, this is not an inconsequential moment.
Right. I was really struck by the lack of specificity about what was going on. You know, your job when you're running as a candidate is to create a difference between you and the other people. And we have big things taking place. We have these two data centers that are being built. We have what ACU is doing with the nuclear power plant. There's talk of other things that we could do. And where is that discussion taking place? Now, Tammy Fogel worked hard to bring up issues like transparency. But when I looked at her stuff, it was about bringing up issues of transparency. What do we want to do about things that are going on? So will they actually get into it? And will they say, let's really debate the data centers. Let's really debate the rising cost of rent and housing. Let's really debate the availability of healthcare here. When I listen to people, that's what they're talking about, but we don't have the politicians stepping up and saying, okay, this is what we should do.
And it's their job to lead on it.
And it's their job to lead. And instead, what I hear is a lot of, yeah, I want to encourage development and we got to work on controlling it. But what does that mean? What should we be doing? How should we be approaching this future?
I want to circle back around to turnout because in Buffalo Gap, there was a mayor's race that was decided by 3 votes. And so the incumbent mayor has now been ousted by three vote margin.
Yeah. So what that tells you is every vote matters. But that also the turnout was pretty low. But again, Buffalo Gap is a smaller community. But still, it was a low turnout. And you know, in a certain sense, when I look at it, I don't see a fight for votes. I see an attempt to get votes, but are we really going after them? I don't know. I'm sure the candidates say they are, but I don't think by looking at the results that they really are.
So if you had one piece of advice for voters looking into the upcoming runoffs, other than getting to the polls because it's their, you know, civic duty, What is the one piece of advice you have for the voters?
I would get in touch with the candidates and find out really what they want to do and how does that match with what your vision is. You know, I would argue Tammy Fogel is a well-established political persona. She's been involved in politics here for a long time. And the other candidate, Bailey, he has been involved for a significantly less time that I have known about, but he's been involved in the community. What do they really want to do? And, you know, Facebook gives you a little bit of information, but if there's an opportunity to go and meet them and to talk to them, I think that would be really valuable. And then the other thing is to vote and tell other people that you're voting too, so that maybe other people will vote. And I realize that's hard to do. I have spent my career trying to get college students to vote, and I've been spectacularly unsuccessful. But that's what we got to do. We got to get more people to care and then to vote.
Well, Paul Fabrizio, we value your time, and thank you so much for sharing your perspective and your time with us today.
Thank you very much. It's always good to be here.
This is the West Texas Dispatch. I'm Heather Claiborne. The Community Foundation of Abilene wrapped up 10 years of the annual philanthropy event known as Abilene Gives with a record-breaking day. When the 12-hour final fiesta ended at 8 o'clock last night, 3,543 donors had given more than $2.5 million to 196 participating organizations. At the kickoff party, hosted at First Financial Bank, Katie Alford, president and CEO of the Community Foundation of Abilene, described the starting point for this final day focused on marshaling the generosity of the local community for the area's nonprofits.
The final fiesta is going great. I think there's so much energy this morning. People are excited. I know some people are kind of sad about it being the last one, but I think we're going to try to go out and make this the best one, the last one. And so it just, the energy this morning was just really good to see with the nonprofits.
Organizers plan this year's event around Cinco de Mayo, offering chili sprinkled fruits, Mexican pastries, and breakfast tacos to fuel the party. There are always extra ways to earn bonuses at the kickoff. This year's nonprofit members found miniature stuffed tacos that had been hidden around First Financial Bank's lobby, and others competed in a Macarena contest. Alfred says her team had a lot of help from local businesses who wanted to be part of the success of this year's Abilene Gives.
A big part of the day is the prizes and sponsorship dollars that we kind of provide every 15 minutes throughout the day for the nonprofits and donors to win extra for their nonprofit or match minutes. And this year we blew past what we had done in previous years. We raised $155,000 to be added to the prize pool. So that was really cool to see that we knew we were going to go into this with a lot of extra dollars being matched or being given as prizes. And so that's what's fun and what drives those donations.
And it wasn't just major businesses that pitched in. Yesterday, 7-in-1 Books gave a book to anyone who had donated to a nonprofit through the Abilene Gives online portal. That piece of generosity was made possible by K.L. Mann, an independent author who moved to Abilene a couple of years ago and learned about this focused day of support for local nonprofits from Arlene Castleman, the owner of 7-in-1.
I wanted to do something with 7-in-1 specifically for a little while. I've been doing like leaving gift cards behind for them to give away to people, and giving books is just my favorite thing. And then Arlene told me about Abilene Gives, and we were like, it's perfect timing. So yeah.
Mann says she enjoyed watching donors show up and pick any book in the store.
It's been crazy. They sold a bunch before I even got here, from like 10 to 12. So that was really cool. And Arlene said it's been like kids on Christmas, just adults getting really excited about it. So that's nice.
Mann had told 7-in-1 she would cover $3,000 worth of books. And then, wanting to make sure people who had been at work all day had a chance to pick a book, she added another $1,000 to her gift. Arlene Castleman says she was thrilled with the opportunity to collaborate on supporting local philanthropy.
I think one of the highlights of 325 Day a couple weeks ago, as well as Abilene Gives yesterday, is how for-profit business can partner with nonprofits to increase awareness and giving on special days. We had people that we could surprise with that came into the store and didn't know. And then they were able to then go on to Abilene Gives and select a charity and donate in the store. I think it increased small donations to a whole lot of nonprofits that perhaps those people would not have given to.
Abilene Gives brought the opportunity to experience the joy of giving not only to the individual donors, but to the organizations and folks like K.L. Mann who found ways to participate at that deeper level. At the end of the day, the leaderboard displayed familiar names at the top. Camp Abel of Buffalo Gap raised the most, more than $183,000. Abilene Education Foundation came in second with more than $96,000. And third place went to All Kind Animal Initiative, which collected $67,000. Over the last 10 years, Abilene Gives has tallied more than $14.5 million in donations. While those dollars have not benefited the Community Foundation directly, the organization has grown significantly in that time, from less than $100 million in assets to more than $250 million. And the annual event has increased the foundation's visibility. As they say farewell to Abilene Gives, Katie Alford says the Community Foundation will bring a fresh approach to their support for local nonprofits.
Next year, we plan on having a 2 or 3 day conference where we're going to bring them back all together and really trying to feed into them, you know, that professional development, like how do you fundraise, market, tell your story, all of those things, but then also have kind of more re-energizing, rejuvenating messages through some of the speakers and just try to feed into them, because what they do is hard every day, and we know that they get worn down and kind of mentally exhausted, psychologically exhausted, and we just want to help them kind of recharge and re-energize.
Abilene Gives officially ended at 8 last night, but the donation portal remains open, and overnight, dozens of additional donors made gifts, and tens of thousands of dollars has been added to the total. Congratulations to all the participants, and thank you to all the generous donors.
It's time for West Texas Roots. West Texas has a habit of drawing in people, from the beautiful landscapes to the slower, more intentional way of life. For Michael Dean and his wife, it was the people of Abilene that made them stay. Michael Dean explains what he does to help out in the community and how certain words carry different meanings here in West Texas.
You would say my story of West Texas is it's inviting, God-fearing people, great place to raise a family. So my wife and I grew up in Kansas City, and we love Kansas City, but after being stationed here twice at Dyess, we fell in love with the community and said we want to call this home, because we never really had a place to be called home because we moved 8 different times in 25 years. So when I had an opportunity to come back at the end of my career to finish up, I jumped at the chance, and because I wanted to be able to call Abilene home. I only retired 3 years ago, but I was here from 2010 to 2015, and then came back in 2020 and haven't left since. I've always been a huge proponent of you take care of the community is always going to take care of you. And I think part of just the way I was raised is giving back. A lot of it was, you know, early on in my youth was through the church. But it's just something I've always believed in. You know, I'm an active volunteer, and I always tell people I'm like a poor volunteer, because volunteers don't get paid. So, but, you know, I try to volunteer, try to give back to the community. Was fortunate enough to go through Leadership Abilene here, and through that made some connections. And then about a year and a half ago, somebody just called me up and said, "You think you might be a good fit to work for a congressman?" And so I said, "Sure, I'd love to." And checked it out and loved it, the best job I ever had. What I love about it most is it really affords me the opportunity to go out and meet more people in the community. And West Texas and Taylor County, the big country specifically, have such amazing people that have such amazing stories. And I fortunately get to go see those people, whereas if I didn't have this job, I wouldn't see 90% of the people I meet. And so just having that ability to go out and meet new people, and that's the reason why I call it God's country, because I love it. I love it, you know. I was at an event one time, and I was helping try to coordinate the event, and somebody said, "We need to get a stripper." And I said, "What?" They said, "We need to get a stripper." I said, "Am I hearing you right? You want to get a stripper?" And they're like, "Yeah, we just need to get a stripper so, you know, we can show it off." And I'm like, "What do you want to show off a stripper?" And they're like, "Yeah." I said, "I don't think we're talking about the same thing." And they're like, "Yeah, it's a piece of farm equipment that stripped the cotton." And I said, "Oh my goodness. Only in West Texas do people just nonchalantly refer to that as a stripper, and they don't even bat an eye. But to an outsider like myself moving in, you mentioned stripper, I would say 99% of the world, they think of one thing, and it's not using it to strip cotton." To this day, very mindful and careful how I use that vernacular, but I do have it, right? It's now firmly in my bailiwick to use, and I use it, you know, it can add some levity to the situation, but I'm mindful of at least prefacing what we're referring to before I start encouraging people to invite strippers to the party.
We recorded Michael Dean's story of living in Abilene at the Taylor County Expo Center. This is the West Texas Dispatch. Next week, Austin ISD Performing Arts Center will begin hosting the UIL one-act play State Meet. That's for public high school theater departments who earned a shot at the championship title. This year, 12 West Texas schools have advanced to the state contest, and 3 schools, including Wiley, placed 3rd at their regional contests as alternate to state. KACU's Allison Diaz tells us about the West Texas Thespians who are preparing for their final bows.
Thousands of high schoolers started one-act play season with dreams of reaching the next contest. all the way to the state competition. Now it's down to 8 schools for each of the 6 divisions. All of them have gotten their timing down to the strict 40-minute limit. And over the last 2 months' worth of performances, they've made adjustments to their movement or the way they deliver the lines, as well as to lighting or even hairstyles. And with less than a week to go, they're still working to make their shows the best they can be. Out of the large group of advancing schools, each one is experiencing a different milestone. Some of the high school theater troupes are seasoned state competitors, and for others, this is a historic first for their community.
And the second school to advance to Austin is Clyde High School.
This is the first time in 40-plus years since Clyde's one-act play has advanced to state. Decked out in turn-of-the-century costumes, Clyde's team tackles the challenge of English accents as they tell the story of the fight for women's rights to graduate from Cambridge in blue stockings by playwright Jessica Swale. Cara Barbie has been teaching theater for 20 years and has been directing at Clyde High School since 2013. Until now, the furthest Clyde got was as an alternate to the state championship. That was in 2023. Now, with limited rehearsals remaining, Barbie says the goal is to polish the show and stay fresh as a company since they have been working on the show for so long.
We started, oh my gosh, auditions in December, and it's May. And, you know, that's a long time for a bunch of high school kids to be working on the same show. So
Barbie says hearing their name called at the region contest was a surprise, especially since some of the other schools at the contest had won more acting awards than Clyde. Barbie says that being able to celebrate with her daughter, a freshman at Clyde, who was in the show, is the best blessing of the whole experience. Clyde High School will perform on May 13th at the Austin ISD Performing Arts Center, taking the stage third in the 6:30 p.m. session.
The first school to advance is Early.
This will be Early High School's second trip to the finals in the past 3 years. Early took home the title of state champions in 2024, placing first with their unique, minimalistic staging of scenes from the play Silent Sky by Lauren Gunderson. This year, Early returns with a similarly simple approach that relies on the actors and the ensemble to shine, and includes a few basic set pieces and props to tell the story of the fight for women pilots from the WASP program to join the space program in the show They Promised Her the Moon by playwright Lauren Olstein. Spanning from the first competition at Zone all the way to the most recent region competition, Early has placed first at each contest. The lead actress, senior Emma Blanton, has earned the Best Performer Award at each of the 5 levels so far.
The other outstanding performer today, from Early, Jerry Cobb.
Considering their most recent success and their victorious appearance at State in 2024, director Katie Tidwell is grateful and hopeful, but isn't taking anything for granted. Tidwell recalls a quote from Travis Poe, renowned high school director and clinician, from the documentary One Act Play, 2018, which she has shown her students.
He says, making it to state is like the best cupcake you've ever had. And he says that, like, the cake itself is going to state. The icing on the cake is, like, placing, like, top 3 or whatever. And then the strawberry or cherry on top is winning. And it's like, okay, well, if you don't get the strawberry or cherry and you don't get the icing, it's still the best cake you've ever tasted. And so that's the philosophy that the kids and I have adopted about it this time going into it. Glad to be going.
Early High School is putting on a public performance for They Promised Her the Moon tonight at the Brownwood Lyric Theater and will perform first next Wednesday at the state competition. One West Texas theater program that knows the route to Austin quite well is Cristoval High School. Next week, Travis Morgenstein Harris, along with co-directors Abby Williams and Christy Cotton, will take their Division IIA theater group to the state contest for the 10th time in the past 25 years. Harris has been at Cristoval High School since 2012 and attributes the success to the theater program that was already established at the school by former director Tamara Kelly. His mission as a theater teacher is to push his students to the next level of performance and excellence to help them conquer whatever opportunities or challenges face them later in life.
I really don't think about, like, guys, we have to go back to state this year. I mean, yeah, that's great, but my ultimate goal is for the kids to feel like they gave their all. That's what it's all about. So I guess that's my motivation, is just the kids.
Other West Texas schools preparing for their moment in the Austin stage lights include 1A schools, Lasbuddy, Brooksmith, Ackerley Sands, Rankin, and Roscoe Highland. Sudan will compete for the 2A title. Canyon and Randall are part of the 4A championship. And at the 5A level, Amarillo and Tascosa made the final cut. Show starts Monday with Division 1A and end on Wednesday with 3A. Then, Districts 4 through 6A compete the following week. I'm Allison Diaz in Abilene.
And we have another 40th birthday flashback to share with you. This one comes from one of our most recent alumni, Olivia Cromas. She set herself apart as a freshman, jumping right into hosting Morning Edition and demonstrating a strong work ethic throughout her years. We're so proud of Olivia, and we'll let her tell you what she's doing now.
Good morning, Abilene. I'm Olivia Cromas, and I am a recent alum of KACU. I worked there from the beginning of my freshman year in 2022 up until I graduated this past December in 2025. I filled many roles while I was there. Radio host, reporter, assistant news producer, and production intern at the very start of our local segment, West Texas Roots. Currently, I'm the video production intern at KERA, and I am loving it. I actually heard about the job through another former KACU employee, Katie Pantoja, who I still get to see around the office now. I feel so grateful to have such an amazing opportunity fresh out of college, and it wouldn't have happened without KACU. During my time there, it would frequently strike me just how important KACU is to the Abilene community. So many people rely on the newscasts, the newsletter, and the local features to stay well-informed and in the know. In a world fraught with misinformation and clickbait, it's essential to have reliable sources of news, both locally and globally. KACU is committed to being that source for the big country, and working there has instilled in me an understanding and a belief in the importance of public media and journalism. Beyond that, KACU helped me gain a deeper appreciation for West Texas as a whole. Talking to people in the big country and hearing their stories helped me feel connected to my college town in a way I wouldn't have experienced otherwise. One of my favorite parts of the job was connecting with the community each month at Coffee with KACU. I met some great people there, and the coffee and good conversations always started my day off on the right foot. I owe so much to this station and to the community in the big country that has continued to support it for so many years. Happy 40th, KACU. Here's to another 40 years of excellence.
This has been the West Texas Dispatch. Thanks for tuning in. Our executive producer is Heather Claiborne, who had help from producers Shayla Conley and Caleb Leger. Our digital editor is Calvin Claiborne. Special thanks to J.C. Gamble, who, as always, wrote our theme. I'm George Levesque.